At the young age of 17, James Curry hoped to escape a hostile home by enlisting in the Marines, and ended up right in the middle of a bloodthirsty, terrible war in Iraq. James survived his tour duty by hiding being gay under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, but then, after returning to his civilian life, lost his first boyfriend and ended up homeless.
Despite these setbacks, James was determined to make something of his life, and after securing a great job as a news producer, he was dealt the hardest blow of all, a medical diagnosis of cancer. Today, Peabody Award-winning journalist and writer James Curry joins us to talk about his new book, Staying Alive: Surviving Abuse, Fighting a War, and Beating Cancer, My First 25 Years, which chronicles his abusive family, military service, forbidden lost love, and the challenges of coming home to fight for your life.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Feast of Fun is made possible because of fierce, fabulous people just like you.
Support your favorite podcast in the world, Feast of Fun, by becoming a Plus member at feastoffun.com/plus and access thousands of legendary shows, all without ads.
Or join us on Patreon at patreon.com/feastoffun. Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, is this James Curry?
Sure is.
Hi, James. This is Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
We're really enjoying reading your book, Staying Alive, Surviving Abuse, Fighting a War, and Beating Cancer, My First 25 Years.
Yeah, how much of it have you finished?
Mark read the whole thing.
I read the whole thing. I usually try and read all the books that come across my way.
I've been noticing that, like, you're doing press, like a lot of the broadcast news people are like, well, I read the press release.
I got through the first four chapter, you know.
There are some anchors who blatantly told me, yeah, I didn't read your book. Right on the air.
Well, you know, sometimes it's hard and you get thrown these at the last minute or something like that. But when I was looking forward to getting the book, and I'm glad I read it. And sometimes I kind of like don't read the end of it, you know, of a book, just so I kind of still have a little bit of mystery about what's happening in the thing. But
gotcha.
You know, I'm super interested in your story. And I was wondering, what was that like that very first day? You know, you were just a young kid and you ended up in a war in Iraq.
Yeah, you know, that's not something I really expected, to be going to war at what I think it was 19 years old. Because, you know, I joined the Marine Corps. A lot of the reason I joined the Marine Corps was because of my sexual identity. I didn't know it at the time. I had a stepfather who was super abusive, who called me faggot, in other words, like that all the time. And, you know, to gay men, faggot is like that word that it's like it almost has a physical reaction when somebody says it. And to me, it still does, even to this day. And I think for that word, you know, sometimes minorities try to take the word back in different groups of people. That is a word that I don't think you can take back. I think there's no good way or good reason to say that word. If you're using that word, generally speaking, you're trying to hurt somebody.
So James, like, you know, in your work in journalism, you've probably encountered a lot of activists, especially in the 90s, who tried to reclaim that word through Queer Nation and ACT UP. I wonder what your thoughts were on that. Like, do you feel like they were not successful?
No, I don't think they were successful. And, you know, within the gay community, I've definitely heard people use that word, you know, just in passing or as kind of like a term of endearment. I don't look at it that way. I even still have trouble with the word queer. And I know now that probably doesn't, it's not offensive or as offensive, but I've probably come from that generation. You know, I grew up in the 90s, so I guess queer was just becoming non-offensive. But even so, when I still hear the word queer, it's still kind of, I still kind of cringe a little bit. You know, I wouldn't want to be called that. Yeah. And not that there's anything wrong with the people who don't mind being called that. For me, that's just still one of those that has a negative connotation.
So in order to escape kind of your abusive family, you enlisted in the Marines, and then you found yourself surrounded by an unnecessary bloodthirsty war in Iraq, George W. Bush's weapons of mass destruction war.
That's true. And, you know, at the time, well, I'm not sure I had the wherewithal to even think analytically about the war, but we didn't think that it was unnecessary at the time. You know, this was still very much in the weapons of mass destruction. This is a just cause, 9/11, all that kind of stuff. We were still very much high on what came after 9/11. You know, we were very patriotic country. You saw American flags everywhere. And I still kind of, I like the idea of being patriotic, but I don't like the idea of going to war. And that's kind of where my view on, you know, war has been shaped, obviously, because I generally feel that war is not something that should ever happen, except in very rare circumstances, you know, where you're attacked on the homeland. And I guess 9/11 might qualify as that, but Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, and we all know that. But as far as what it was like for a 19-year-old to be in a war like that, you know, it's kind of a surreal experience. Your training, I guess, essentially prepares you for it in some ways, because you're very reactive. But also the emotional part of it, which is really what this book focuses on. The book does not focus on the political or the day-to-day of what a war was. It was really what was going on inside of my head. Mm-hmm. And for me, I don't know that you could ever prepare for that, or there's nothing you could really do that would prep you for that kind of thing. But for me, the realistic possibility that I could die, that was very real to me. And it's a feeling most people probably have never felt. For me, in a lot of ways, it was a day-to-day thing. And what really made that feeling kind of tangible, if you can make feelings tangible, was we all know what dog tags are. Troops wear dog tags to identify their bodies when they die in action. And I didn't wear my dog tags every day because the metal turned my neck green, but because it was an allergic reaction. But on days that I thought I would die, I put those on because I wanted people to be able to identify my body in the event that, you know, I didn't make it.
You're allergic to nickel?
Whatever cheap metal is in those dog tags, it used to make my neck turn green and made me look even dirtier than I was.
And they can't give you like a brass dog tag or something else that wouldn't have a reaction?
I don't really think that's in the DOD's budget, to be honest with you.
Hypoallergenic stainless steel, please.
Exactly.
My dad served in World War II, and he'd missed the Battle of the Bulge but he was in the invasion of Normandy, and then he returned to his troops. And he told me at one point in time when they'd crossed the Rhine that, you know, he'd gone through some horrendous things, and he just kind of like looked out and he said, like, everything after this is just gravy. That no matter what, like the suffering that I've had or I've gone through, everything else, like that's behind me now. And then right now, this is extra. Everything I have is extra. And I have to appreciate that. Did you ever have a moment similar to that?
Yeah, almost every day in everyday life. You know, it's one of the cliche interview questions that people ask in job interviews is, how do you handle stress? And I always have the same answer. I'm always like, listen, I survived a war and I beat cancer. And I've only worked in news. So I always say, you know, there's nothing in your newsroom that's really going to stress me out. And I feel that way every day. You know, it's very difficult, especially, you know, we talk about the entitled generation. I guess I'm part of that because I'm a millennial. But it is very hard to articulate those kind of things to my colleagues and my peers because they don't have the same perspective that I do in terms of the war and those kind of things. So when people are complaining about, you know, the Starbucks line is too long, or, you know, the barista was mean to them, I always reflect on, you know, the war and the hardship and those kind of things. And not just that, you definitely, living overseas in developing nations, you have a greater perspective of what suffering really is. And whatever problem you're going through here, most of the time, the United States is not really suffering.
James, I imagine that you were aware of your sexual identity at the time that you started to serve in Iraq.
For me, my gay story is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. A lot of people feel like that they knew they were gay from day one, or from a very early age, they had some kind of awakening or some kind of feeling that they were different. I didn't have that feeling. I identified as asexual. I don't know. It just never really occurred to me. Now, there were women that I looked at that were attractive, but it wasn't anything that I would, like, you know, it would not make me go crazy about. But I can't say that about men either. I can't think of, like, you know how a lot of gays have their childhood crush? I don't have that. It didn't occur to me that I was gay. Yeah. I guess maybe in boot camp, I had some idea because I remember looking at other men that I thought, I would have called it an attraction now, but at the time, I didn't think so. It was just like an admiration. I was like, because I didn't have a positive male influence.
I just think Dennis in Platoon 6 is fantastic. We're the best of friends.
He's in such good shape.
You know, because for a lot of young people enlisting today, their frame of reference in serving in the military is usually either, you know, pop culture films like Private Benjamin or Bill Murray Stripes, or it's pornography.
Right. And I can't say that any of those are an accurate representation of the Marine Corps. But you also have to keep in mind.
So it's not sexy at all. And it's not hilarious.
Is there
a drill sergeant saying, "Private Curry, what is your major malfunction? Drop on the floor and give me 50. You know, you're like, it's not that at all.
Well, the thing is, boot camp is very stressful, and that's on purpose. So the least sex was really the furthest thing from my mind in that sense. And not to mention, you don't really shower that well. You're kind of unkept. You're just a little bit disgusting. So even the most, attractive recruit is still disgusting. You know what I mean? I still remember like the smells of like just dirt and filth.
Did you feel like they intentionally make it not sexy? Because, I mean, like, I, you know, there is a propaganda element to recruiting young queer people that I notice on social media, where they have video after video of attractive young men giving head to bananas. You've seen this.
That's a recruiting.
It's not a recruiting video, but it's put out there. But, you know,
there's a rule that we have here that if there's a brand association with a viral video, chances are the brand itself is somewhat responsible for making it visible. And that brand is the U.S. military. And certainly, you know, in films like Transformers or the film Top Gun, I personally, one of my best friends, he enlisted in the Air Force because his latent youthful homosexuality was triggered by, you know, Maverick riding his tail, you know, in Top Gun.
Well, here's what I will say. I can't speak for the other services, what I'm about to say will piss off a lot of Marines, but I believe the Marine Corps has more gay men in it than any other branch of service. And I think that really stems from why I joined. So I joined to be tough, to show that I wasn't a pussy, that I wasn't a faggot, to show that I could, you know, do something that masculine men do. Because in my brain, a gay man was not masculine. And I did that to show all of those kind of things. And I think a lot of people do join the Marine Corps with that same intention. Like, that was not unique to me. Because the Marine Corps is really the land of misfit toys. It's people who have a chip on their shoulder. They have something to prove. They're hard. They want to be hardcore. And those actually are all good qualities. I don't say that in a negative way, because sometimes those can be the drivers for success. But Marines are generally overachieving people. Those are the kind of qualities that I think a lot of gay men, when they're trying to figure themselves out, also have. And they do want to overcome all the stigma and stereotype that goes with being gay. And sometimes they turn to if they're going to turn to the military, I think the Marine Corps is where they actually end up.
That overachiever element is very common or pervasive in LGBTQ people, because we're sort of the middle children of society. So in order to get the attention that we're needing as human beings, we tend to overcompensate in music, language, fitness.
You want to be the Boy Scout, you know?
Yeah. And so a lot of us get attracted into jobs or positions that are multidisciplinary because of that aspect, right? And so for you, do you feel like the military, the Marines was an appealing because of that?
Yes, absolutely. I think so. I definitely think so. Would I have been able to articulate that at the time? No, not at all.
Yeah.
In hindsight, absolutely. That's actually the psychology that was happening in my brain at the time. That's exactly what it was. And there were other things. Like, I remember the recruiter I met. He was a sexy man. But would I have been able to say that at the time? No. But I think that was what brought me to him. He was attractive in some way, but I didn't recognize that as a homosexual or gay or whatever, a man-on-man attraction at the time. You know, these are not thoughts that I was able to figure out until afterwards.
They've kind of noted that, like, I think of, maybe it was 10 years ago, there's some videos going around about these recruiters, and it was just like, it almost looked like they were cruising these young men in a parking lot, you know? And it kind of made the rounds, and people were like, this is what they're doing to get people into the military these days.
Well, you know, I served under Donuts Don't Tell, so I don't know if they were directly trying to target gay men. In fact, I remember having to sign a paper saying that I wasn't gay and that I wouldn't engage in same-sex activity while in the Marine Corps. That was obviously that did happen. But I don't know that, but I do know recruiters, generally speaking, they have to be attractive people. They have to have some element of charisma. They have to be able to sell things because that's what they are. Mm-hmm. They're salesmen, and they have to be able to, you know, if you have this, you know, I hate to say this, you have an unattractive recruiter, who's going to really want to talk to him?
And
you
know, there's also another viral video that came around not too long ago, and it's a lot of people in their first tour. I'm not sure if they're in the Army or what branch of the military they were in. And they're like, hey, what would you like to say to your recruiter? And pretty much every single one of them, like they have 30 different people, and every one of them is pretty much an F you. Like
oh, wow.
They really felt like, well, they feel, you know, betrayed by the recruiter. A lot of people, they promise them a bunch of stuff, and then it doesn't necessarily come through.
I think, but that is true. I wouldn't fall into that category because I did kind of know what I was getting myself into. I knew it was going to be shitty. That's actually why I was seeking it out. Mm-hmm. But I also didn't think past boot camp. You know, boot camp is the hardest part of the, not the hardest part. In the beginning, it's the hardest part of the Marine Corps. And so I really just thought, let's just get through that. I didn't think about all the other stuff. And I didn't have any promises. Like I didn't join because I needed college money or travel the world. Those did happen, but that's just part of the package. I didn't ask for any of that stuff. I just needed to get the hell out of my home life and figure shit out.
James, do you feel like you got in the military because you were hoping it may set you straight?
In some ways, I think that's probably true. But I wouldn't have been, like I said, I didn't know that I was gay at the time. Yeah. So I just think I was looking for masculinity in some way. Because I didn't, and the thing is, I didn't even know I was lacking masculinity. Like I didn't have a fatherly figure who was any worth looking up to. So once I had a positive male influence, the light bulb came on. I was like, holy shit, this is what it's supposed to be like. This is what that void that boys generally don't have if they have a real father in the picture. And that's, I was able to identify
that. Who was
that
positive male influence in the first time in your life? Because it wasn't your father.
Yeah. No, the first positive male influences that I saw were my Marine Corps drill instructors. Like they embodied everything that I thought a man was supposed to be. You know, they were tough, masculine, and I have since learned some of them were gay, but I didn't know that at the time, but those are the things. And the thing is, a drill instructor, the Hollywood depiction of a drill instructor is like this really mean, nasty guy. And yes, they are mean and nasty, but you could also tell they also mentor you in a way. So there's definitely a positive aspect to that. And their meanness diminishes as time goes on in boot camp. So you do get to see the softer side of them. They're not pricks the entire time.
Yeah, one of my favorite managers at work was actually a Marine drill sergeant. And he was the kindest, sweetest guy. And I would always go up to him and do like Gomer Pyle kind of imitations. And he's like, it's not like that at all. It's like, I have a really hard time. His name's Eddie. I have a really hard time imagining you being cruel or mean to anybody. He's like, yeah, well, that's why I got out of it. You know, because it was psychologically exhausting.
Yes, it is. And, you know, drill instructors, the job of a drill instructor is very prestigious in the Marine Corps. Everyone who's held that billet, people in the Marines look up to. But also, it's a three-year tour, and it's a three-year tour for a reason. They have a high suicide rate. They have a high domestic violence rate. They have a high divorce rate. And it's because, I believe, they have trouble turning that off. So, you know, you're in mean mode all day long. You go home and you start talking to your wife the same way you talk to recruits. And, you know, that's generally frowned upon. So it's a tough job. And that, you know, they make Marines. And that's the first Marine you see when you get off that bus at Parris Island at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I think there is something to be said for that, because that image for every Marine is burned into your head. You know, when I'm old and have Alzheimer's and can't remember anything, I'll remember my Marine Corps drill instructors.
In terms of the war in Iraq, what was the most visceral experience that you had there?
When I was flying into Iraq, I was on a helicopter from Al-Asad Air Base into Fallujah. And the thing that sticks out in my brain is, okay, you know, you're flying, whatever, everything's fine. And we started taking fire from rocket-propelled grenades. Obviously, we didn't get hit. Everything was fine eventually when we landed. But it was the very first time in my 19-year-old existence that I thought I was going to die. I was like, holy shit, this is over. It's done. Like, we're done right now. And it's a very calming feeling, surprisingly, but it's also one that I'll never forget. And it's, like I've said before, I just don't think people that young should experience that kind of thing ever, especially in a war zone.
Do you think people have experienced that to some degree living under this pandemic in this past year?
Potentially, but I don't know that it's as immediate because you don't just drop dead from COVID, you know, and there, I guess there's some element of hope with COVID, even if you do end up dying from it. In the war, like you, for me, I had like this, like you have a mini conversation with yourself. Like you may die today. Like that's it. Today's might be it. And it, you, I don't know that there's words to articulate what that feeling is really like, but it's just an odd acceptance, I guess you could say.
Did they keep you separated or away from seeing the negative impact that you had on the people in those communities in Iraq?
There was no concerted effort to separate us. There were some things that they thought were better PR, and this was really controversial in some platoons because one of the things they used to frown on is us wearing sunglasses. And the reason most of us wore sunglasses is because the sunglasses we were issued were ballistic, which means that if something blew up around us, the shrapnel, our eyes would hopefully be protected from the shrapnel. But a lot of the Marine Corps leadership at the time, and I don't know Marine Corps why, this was my unit, they felt that it made us look like machines and less personable, and the general public didn't want to associate with us because of that. And I recognized that, but it also made us feel unprotected, and it also felt like our leadership didn't give a shit about us.
They could have put like googly eyes and made you look like a monster.
They could have. They could have. But you know, I do think the leadership at the time, there was an effort to engage with the community. Was it successful? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think Americans are still hated abroad in many, many places, and Iraq is probably one of those places even still today. Even though, you know, we did a lot of good for that country, we have done a lot of bad as well. Mm.
So you get back to the United States, you stopped serving at a certain point in time, right?
I did, but not right after the war. I still had 3 years left in the Marine Corps. And I actually got, as soon as I got back from Iraq, I got selected for a special duty in the Marine Corps that where Marines guard embassies. And I got to guard the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi, India, Lome, Togo, and Ottawa, Canada. So I got to see different sides of the military. Traditionally, especially at that time, you only saw the war part or the green part. I got to see the blue and the green because the embassy duty, there is a security component to that, but it also is a very showpiece kind of thing. You know, you always wear your dress blues. When an American comes into an embassy, the first person they see is a U.S. Marine standing there. So there was that aspect of it. And for me, that was a very rewarding duty. It was rigorous and intense and all of those things. I got to meet the President of the United States and the Secretary of State, the First Lady, and all these great things that would have never happened had I not been chosen for that duty. And otherwise,
you also got to meet the first love of your life, right?
I did, and that's actually where I kind of figured out I was gay. Mm-hmm. Like, actually confirmed it in New Delhi. There was a Marine one rank above me. Essentially, he was my boss. And one day, him and I decided, you know, like normal Marines do, is to get shit faced drunk at 7 o'clock in the morning after PT. And you know, and one thing led to another, and he kissed me, and all of a sudden that was fireworks because I had kissed. Yeah, I know. I think Marines are hot in general, but
I lived with a Marine for a little while. He was pretty hot, but man, was he asshole. I bet he was.
Well, that sometimes that comes to the territory. but I've learned to soften in my old age, so I'm not as much of an asshole. But
so after
he was my mentor.
Sex, you cuddle.
Oh yeah, exactly. But that Marine that kind of confirmed my sexual identity. He was my mentor. He was the Marine that I wanted to be like. And that kind of goes back to what I was saying about the recruiter. Is I looked at him as my mentor, but I was probably more attracted to him. I just didn't know how to, I had never experienced that before, so I didn't know what those feelings were. So although I liked that he was my mentor, I was definitely attracted to him, and I thought he was hot as fuck. And when he kissed me, I thought this was like, oh my God, this is a fairy tale here. Is this really happening to me?
And eventually he breaks your heart.
Of course, like every we all have that gay story, right?
Did you ever have any closure with him at all? Was that ever able to talk about it?
Never did. The last time I spoke to him was when I was on chemotherapy during my cancer treatment, and he said he called me and he said, "Hey, I heard you're going through some challenges or some bullshit like that." And I literally was about to throw up, not because of him, but because of the chemotherapy. And I was just like, we'll talk about this some other time. Hung up the phone, went and threw up. Never really wanted to have that conversation. For me, I had moved on. You know, I think that's, I went through a mourning phase after that relationship was over. Like a lot of people, there's like a mourning, you know, it was almost like a death. But once I was done, I was done. I didn't want to rekindle that relationship. And I think we as gays are guilty of that too much, of going back and like, what the fuck are we doing?
We've all done it. I've done it in this relationship right here. Do you think if the don't ask, don't tell was implemented while you were still serving, do you think you would have stayed in the Marines, or were you eager to get out regardless?
No, actually, my don't ask, don't tell experience was actually pretty positive. Serving as a gay Marine in the Marine Corps, my fellow Marines felt like it was more of a brotherhood. They didn't give a shit about my sexuality, because towards my last year in the Marine Corps, I didn't hide it. I stopped caring. My fellow Marines knew, and they protected that, I guess, secret. And they looked at it as more of a practical thing. They were like, you know, if we tell on you and you get sent home, we're going to have to stand more duty. We're going to have to do more work. So they looked at it as very practical, and it fell under the brotherhood category. I had other goals. I wanted to get out of the Marine Corps. I wanted to pursue a civilian career. And that's why I got out. If I didn't have those goals, I'd be retiring next year at age 37, which is unbelievable.
Wow.
And you had a lifelong passion for journalism that you pursued while you were serving in the military.
I did. I always wanted to be a journalist. You know, when I was a kid, my favorite show was the news. And I know that's sad, but it's true. So
who was your favorite anchor?
Peter Jennings, by far, by far. Yeah. And, I could name all the local anchors from all the TV stations where I grew up. I mean, that's how ridiculous my obsession with the news was. So I knew I wanted to get into news. I didn't know what aspect of news. I originally thought I wanted to be a newspaper reporter. And when I started talking to people, they're like, nah, you'll probably be unemployed a lot if you pursue that road. So I looked into television and I found the producing path, which it was kind of fate. I don't know. I like being in control as a Marine. I think that's probably inherent, type A a little bit. And that's what a producer does. You know, a lot of people don't know what a producer does. Everyone hears the word thrown around, and in a lot of places it means a lot of different things. But essentially, in the news world, the producer is the person in charge. They decide who's going to cover what angles are going to happen, what stories are going to be covered, what order they'll happen in the newscast, and all those kind of things. And that just really, really appealed to me.
That's when you have a budget.
Well,
but most of the times it's like, you know, the local news channels, it's usually, you know, the person in front of the camera is the one who's like writing the questions and is like working with the editor afterwards. And it's like, there's not a lot of, you know, teamwork dedicated to a news story. But in your case, you had, you worked for CNN, you're a 3-time Peabody winning award journalist. But before you
That's
got
true.
Into all of this, or at what point did you find out? And I guess this sounds like, you know, an episode of Saturday Night Live's Debbie Downer. You're like, my career with journalism was going so well until I found out I had cancer.
Yeah. Let's back up a little bit. So I did work in local news a little bit before I got to CNN. CNN was going to be the 10-year plan. Generally speaking, you don't get to CNN or the network until you're well into your career. For me, I only had a little bit over a year of experience, and I got to CNN. I was 25 years old. I was one of the youngest producers ever hired in the history of the company. And as soon as I walked in the door, I was in charge of shit. I was in charge of anchors who I grew up watching. I remember Natalie Allen, who's a fantastic friend of mine now. I remember her saying to me, James, I've been on the air longer than you've been alive. And that was absolutely true, you know? And how do you guide somebody like that? How do you lead them? How do you serve as the person in charge of them?
What did you do to guide her?
Drill sergeant?
No. In fact,
all right,
I learned
that. We're going to do this push-ups segment on Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt's romance.
Yeah. I've learned that doesn't work in the civilian world, and it's frowned upon in the corporate environment. But what I found was you have to sometimes manipulate talent. Manipulate's the negative way of saying that. Lead is the positive way, or influence. And what I did is I just listened to them. And most of the time they had really good ideas because of their experience. But sometimes, because you're the producer, you have to take charge and carry out the plan of the day. And the thing is, what they say, the anchors, is often only in their self-interest. Not all the time, but a lot of times it is. It's what's going to work out best for them.
You know, James, I really want to do a story about going to a spa where we talk about me getting a pedicure and a massage. I actually work for one of the largest gay newspapers. This is a true story. And my dear friend, Louis Weisberg, he managed to get a facelift as
on
the cover
dime,
yeah. on the company dime on a and made it the cover story. And my friend Jason Smith was taking pictures of Louis during the operation with his half of his face removed, and he passed out.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Luckily, I haven't had to encounter anything like that.
Yeah.
But what I was just going to say is, you know, the producer is held accountable. So like, no matter what the anchor wants, no matter how powerful and how strong their personality is, you have to figure out a way to stand up to that and deal with that in a way that's not going to be confrontational. That's not, because the other part is, you know, they have to go on TV. So you can't fight with them and then expect them to go out on TV and perform in the way that you want them to. So a lot of it is an exercise in discipline and learning about tone and how to talk to people, when to say what, figuring out what makes them tick. Producing the editorial journalism part, that's like 10% of it. 90% of it is managing personalities. And I'm not saying all of the news anchors I've worked with were prima donnas or divas, but everyone has their own way to get somebody to perform, and you have to find those as a producer. Did you ever watch the news and something goes wrong? Either the anchor doesn't know which way they're going, or they're lost.
That's a cockroach comes into the room and you're scared and you're the weatherman and you go, oh my God, this is going to be on the internet now.
Aside from queening out weathermen, most of that is because the relationship between the producer and the anchor failed in some way.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're there in the room while the news story is unfolding, or you're somewhere involved as it's being done?
Yeah. So when the anchor is in the studio, there's a control room full of people who are making everything happen. The anchor literally, and a lot of times nowadays, we don't have camera people anymore. That's kind of a thing in the past. Everything's robotic. The anchor's in the studio by themselves. The control room, which is where the producer sits, the director, the technical director, the sound people, they're the ones making everything happen. The producer is in the control room. They're the ones who talk in the anchor's ear. And, you know, that's an art. This is super inside baseball, by the way. But that's an art in and of itself, because you can't talk to somebody while they're also talking. So you have to figure out how to get information to them in between breaths sometimes, you know?
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. I, you know, the most famous moment in pop culture journalism is, you know, in The View, when Rosie O'Donnell and was it Elizabeth Hasselbeck?
Yes.
Had the split screen. And I read about that in the in Barbara Walters' book Audition, where the producers were trying to talk to Rosie while she was arguing with Elizabeth. And so they're barking stuff into her ear while they're fighting with each other. And it was so incredibly stressful that Rosie O'Donnell said, I'm done.
Well, she also saw the split screen or something like that too. And it was just like, you can't do that to me.
She felt that it was very manipulative at that point in time.
That is true. I don't think the producer should be blamed for Rosie O'Donnell quitting The View. I think there's other problems here.
Yeah.
But what I would say to a situation like that, especially, you know, having done similar things, that was probably less spontaneous and more planned than they wanted us to believe. And I say that just because when you do a split screen, that's not something you just do on the fly. That has to be set up ahead of time. So the director has to frame the shot for each camera, set up the graphics, and then take the split. That's not something that just happened. So I suspect that they did something, and whether intentional or not, or overt or covert, to spark that debate, knowing that that was going to erupt into this huge, you know, outrageous bloodbath on TV. I was just going to say, news producers typically don't do things like that. Mm. Entertainment producers, which is what The View is, I could see them doing that without a doubt. You know, news producers were a little bit more discreet when we do things like that. Mm. But at the end of the day, I tell people this, and this really upsets a lot of hardcore journalists and a lot of college students. News is a business. In this country, it's a for-profit operation. And if it's not making money, you will all lose your jobs. And sometimes you have to sex up the news, make it entertainment so that people watch. And that sounds bad, but it's just the reality. News is here to make money. In this country, we put journalists up on this pedestal, acting like, you know, they're doing God's work. That's all bullshit.
So by that sexing mean- up and making money, are you saying that Anderson Cooper should start an OnlyFans? I mean, that's kind of, you know, how we, the pressure that we feel doing this podcast. Sometimes it's like, it's not enough to make an entertainment, informative, interesting show. I feel like even our audience is like, when are you guys going to like do the Rasputin challenge and take your shirt off? You know, and, it's, and I'm wondering, like, from your perspective as a gay man who, you know, we'll get to the talking about cancer, which we haven't talked about yet, but who's overcomes all this adversity. And, you know, you have three Peabody Awards, which is not something you accidentally get. Mm-hmm. You know, you said in your talking points that you feel like the state of, you know, corporate media or news media, news organizations today are really not there to help the American public.
No, definitely not. I look at media the same way I look at a for-profit college or university. Can they do good work? Absolutely. But generally speaking, they're there to exploit the public to gain something. And in our case, that's money. It's a business. Mm-hmm. You know, in rare instances, maybe NPR, and even NPR is not a good example because they have to some way solicit donations. So
NPR is like the worst, I think, because they're the ones who are like, we're public radio. And right. Here's the long list of heartless multinational corporations who fund most of our stuff.
Exactly.
There's like supermarket, ADM supermarket to the world.
Who is Monsanto.
Like Monsanto. You know. Like some of the most bloodthirsty, heartless, cruel corporations are bankrolling NPR. And to yes. me, I'm just kind of like, God, can yeah. we trust anything that comes out of your...
And, you know, I'm an NPR listener, but it's a very yeah. pretentious news organization. And I think that's sometimes what happens when you gain some element of prestige, you get that way. You know, a lot of us get into news because we're freedom fighters in some way. We mm-hmm. want to change the world, right every wrong, expose mm-hmm. corruption. When you recognize or learn, depending on the goals of your organization, that that's yeah. not going to happen, you kind of... lose your whatever it was, the fire that got you into the business to begin with. And that's sad, but I suspect that's the same thing for a lot of professions. You know, police officers become jaded and so on and so forth, you know?
Well, we have like some local media organizations that have been around forever, and some of them are trying to have gone, you know, the Chicago Reader, for one, is a local newspaper that everybody read all the time. It was free. It was everywhere. They've gone more online, but they're trying to go the model of, you know, donations. They're asking people to become members and to get sponsorships from people just to kind of keep it going. So if, you know, and media, like people aren't buying ads in the newspapers anymore, and radio spots are down, and even podcasts, it's sometimes hard to advertise on. So, I mean, where do you see, what is the future of journalism?
I don't know what the future is. I think that journalism in the way that we traditionally thought of it, and I know this is not an original idea or thought, is dead. I mean, but we also have to look at the history of American journalism. Journalism has never really been a noble profession. We think of like Alexander Hamilton founded the New York Post. And why did he do that? He did that because he wanted to push his agenda. That's always been true. Traditionally, it's rich white guys who push their agenda. I just don't think that we're ever going to see a non-biased, non-partisan news organization that has the public's best interest in mind. Like now, like I said, they can do great stories that do very good things for people. But overall, when you're sitting in that editorial meeting, especially as a producer who's charged with, you have to have some deliverables. So if your ratings are down, you have to figure out how to get them up or you're going to lose your job. That's the bare bones, simple reality of television news and probably other mediums as well. And now there's other things that go into that, but when you boil it all down, that's really what it comes to. And how do you make people read something? How do you make people watch something? You can't necessarily make them do it, but you could try to make it look as attractive to them. That is why Fox News operates the way it does. You know, forget about the political side of Fox News for just one second. If you watch Fox News on mute, it's eye candy. It's fun to watch. Flashy graphics. Everything is shiny. Women don't wear pants and all of those kind of things. Those are very deliberate things. That's not on accident. That's on purpose.
Yeah, there is a sort of an erotic quality to the female newscasters on Fox News where they're always like blonde and, you know, kind of softer in makeup, even though like, you know, somebody like Laura Ingraham probably in real life is pretty, you know, tough and brutal, but they do like paint her up to soft. And even Rachel Maddow, you know, on MSNBC, yeah. she says that she's in drag. Mm-hmm. Like that, yeah. that she normally would not wear that much makeup or have her look softened to some degree. But, you know, well, I guess I'm curious. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I've actually had the opportunity to interact with Rachel Maddow when she's not on TV. And she looks like some skater teenager. They're wearing Vans and really big pants. And yeah, when you see her on TV, that's about as feminine and non-lesbian as she'll probably ever get or ever be. And I don't say that in a negative way.
A very well-paid skater punk who makes an amazing yes. cosmopolitan.
yes.
Have
yes.
you ever had her make you a cocktail?
I have not.
If anybody listening out there, if Rachel Maddow invites you to her apartment to have cocktails, do not say no.
yeah, my interaction with her was in a professional sense. I was interviewing to work on that show, and I got to interact with her one-on-one in her office, but also sit through an editorial meeting with her. And generally speaking, the anchor or host, she probably falls into the host category, doesn't run the editorial meeting. In her case, she does, and she tells everybody exactly what she's thinking, what she wants for the broadcast, after she's analyzed the topic. It's a very academic way of approaching television, right. which is non-traditional. Because, you know, her whole show is basically her, you know, lecturing for an hour. That breaks all the rules when it comes to TV, because traditionally, TV has always been, you have to show some kind of video or a graphic element. You have to do something visually pleasing. So the person, you know, she breaks all those rules and she does it pretty effectively.
Mm. Well, you know, and I'm curious to know what your thoughts about podcasting is as somebody who worked for CNN for a good part of their careers, because, you know, for us, we started this podcast 16 years ago in a world where it was all audio blogs. And there was not a lot of journalism being done. And, you know, so we had to, one, explain to people what a podcast is, what journalism is, what an audio magazine is, and that we had to, like, prepare them to some degree, like, what to expect. And in terms of, like, news organizations, I always felt that they looked at us very confused. Because they were,
Yeah, you know, for one, the word podcast is kind of a dated word anyway, because it comes from iPod. Who the hell has an iPod anymore, right?
It was dated back in when it began.
We used to call it an online radio show.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
It was dated, and I'll tell you this little piece of history. Apple started the podcast directory as a settlement between the people who are using the term podcasting because it was a branded name. And Apple, the corporation, didn't want them using that name. So one settlement that they had was moving a lot of established directories onto iTunes at the time in order to, you know, basically sort of bring back or reclaim the term. But at this point in history now, you know, podcast is just as, you know, ubiquitous as a word. I don't know. I guess Kleenex is still a brand name for tissue, but, you know, it's something that, like, no one owns the copyright to the word podcast anymore.
Right, right. I think podcasting is great. I listen to a bunch of them, and I feel like the storytelling has never been better. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it's true, just the actual storytelling. But also, as you guys probably know, podcasting is a very crowded space. Everybody has a freaking podcast now, and it's hard to sort through all of that stuff to find the good ones. I also think, though, TV outlets or media outlets, they generally throw away the podcast opportunity because some of the things, they're starting to get more into original programming with their podcasts, but even still, you now see a lot of throwaways. So like, if you get like, let's say, and I don't know if this is true, but let's just use this as an example, the Anderson Cooper podcast, it's usually just stuff regurgitated from his primetime show on CNN. And that's true with a lot of news organizations. They just package it in audio form and put it on a podcast distribution system, and there you go.
Well, one I think of the that's first podcast shitty. That was like that was the Simpsons podcast that was launched, I believe, in 2006, and it was literally the commercial, a 15-second commercial for that episode that was going to air that evening.
It's like a tease, yeah.
Liz, like this is the Simpsons podcast. This Sunday, Homer and Marge go to a book club with hilarious results. Check it out on Fox at 8 p.m. Central. Like that was basically their podcast. And to this day, I think it's really interesting. Like, you know, the move, I think, you know, NPR Serial really kind of took over that space and really you know, brought in a lot of new life. But for people like us, I feel like sometimes we're like, you know, I don't know if you saw the movie Up, where that little old yep. man has the house and the big city is built around them.
Right.
You know, and they're trying to pressure him to like give up or quit. And we're still here and you're here on the show with us, which I think is really fantastic. And that the fact that we're able to have this like in-depth conversation about a book or a person's life is really extraordinary, you know, and I'm wondering, like, if you are starting your broadcasting or your journalism career today, do you think you may have taken a different path because of all the options you have now?
I don't think so. And the main reason is probably down to money. Do you really make a lot of money doing a podcast? You know, TV also is not something people get into because of the money. But when you measure it against all the other mediums, print, radio, and online, TV is still the top paying outlet. And that's just the reality of the way
it is. It's a difference between starting a business and having a job. You know, when you have a job, it's somebody else's responsibility to pay you. When you have a business, it's your responsibility to make the money and do your job.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And yeah, and that's, you know, when you're a business owner, you have to constantly worry about that revenue stream. Whereas if you're just an employee, I shouldn't say just an employee, but if you're an employee, you think your job is always going to be there. But as we know, TV is a very unstable industry. And, you know, every place I've worked at has had routine layoffs. Luckily, I've never been victim of them.
So we have to talk about your cancer diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, kind of the focus here of the book, Staying Alive. I mean, besides surviving war and abuse and heartache and, you know, being in the trenches in broadcast journalism, would you feel like, you know, being diagnosed and going through chemotherapy at such a young age was probably the hardest thing you've ever had to do emotionally?
No doubt. And probably physically too. Cause the sickest I've ever been in my life has been on chemotherapy. Yeah. Cancer was a life changing thing for me in a lot of ways. If I usually tell people, if I didn't get sick, I'd probably be like the president of CNN or something like right now, because I was on that meteoric rise. I was 24 years old, youngest producer, and I was promoted 3 times while I was there in the course of that 7 years. I was on that trajectory. Cancer was a slap in the face from like the fucking universe. It was like God's way or whatever. I use God, but whatever you feel, was his way of saying, slow the fuck down, feel shit, live in this moment, all that kind of stuff. Or maybe that's my fucking brain trying to justify the cancer experience. I don't know. But for me, it definitely changed everything. It totally showed me that a job is not important. It's not your life. It's not your identity. It's not who you are. It's exactly that. Just a job, no matter what it is. Because if you don't have your health, what the fuck do you have? You have nothing. I mean, it doesn't matter how many days you spend at work. I mean, you're dead. Also, when I was going through cancer treatment, people from all over the world, because of the platform that I had as a journalist, but also my colleagues from all over the world, because, you know, CNN's a big organization, were reaching out to me and just seeing how I was doing. I didn't know any of these people. And I used to think to myself, why the fuck is this person emailing me or texting me or whatever? And it's because they actually cared, because you don't do that if you don't care. And one of the things, I had this fantastic boss at CNN. She, when I first got the diagnosis, she told me to make a list of my 10 most favorite foods and give it to her.
Oh, wow.
And she made them and brought them to my house. You know, who does that? Like that's really seeing the human element of the workplace and all those kind of things that I'd kind of shut off. I was like, I don't want to feel anything.
Amazing cook. This person was like making like, you know, beef stroganoff and lasagna. And
exactly. And there's other things, you know, over the course of the time that I got sick. And then when I got better, that's when I was having, like, this wasn't an overnight epiphany. But you know, you learn that relationships are the most important thing in life, not to get all soft, not your job, not your status, not any of those things. It's who's in your life and who makes you feel good on that level. And that really set the path, because, you know, like most gays, I shouldn't say, I'm totally generalizing, I don't know if this is true, but, you know, I didn't really date men. I hooked up with a bunch of men, but I didn't really spend time to try to get to know them. I didn't give a shit. The cancer experience...
They're listening to the show and they're going, uh-huh.
They know. They know. That's right, they already James. Know. every guy in the Atlanta dating scene at that time knows who I am. I'm sorry to say. So yeah, but cancer really softened all that stuff. It taught me, no, don't treat people like shit. You know, there is some, you know, as journalists, we hear often deal with all the shitty parts of society. I actually got to see a lot of the good things because of cancer, you know, and that's not just my colleagues and stuff like that. Cancer patients, you know, in a cancer ward, it's very different. You know, when you go to the doctor's office, you sit in the waiting room, and generally speaking, you don't talk to one another. You're not like, what are you here for? In a cancer ward, it is like that. People are asking, hey, I have, you know, this kind of cancer. What did your chemo do to you? It did this to me. How does it, you know, all those kind of things. People are sharing their stories. To me, that was very helpful in a lot of ways. Because I think there is some comfort in knowing somebody else is going through exactly what you're going through. Mm-hmm. That's actually kind of how I got to the book, because CNN asked me to write a piece for CNN.com about what it was like to be a cancer survivor. And I've always told people that being a cancer survivor is harder than being a cancer patient, mainly because of the psychological impact. Because as a cancer patient, you already know everything that's happening. Your doctors have told you, you have generally have a treatment plan, all those kind of things. For me, that's great. When I got to the survival aspect, the way a lot of gay men will relate to this, it's every time I got tested for cancer, which was once a month in the beginning, it felt like when you get an HIV test, you know, that anxiety, mm-hmm. that, oh my God, you know, there's many times I've convinced myself that I had cancer again because of all of, you know, the craziness. Every time your body does something, headache, stomach ache, or whatever, you think it's cancer. That's not a healthy way to live. The worst thing my oncologist did was give me his personal email address. And I used to email him with all, hey, this hurts, whatever. And eventually he's like, dude, you got to stop emailing me. This is getting a little bit ridiculous. But for me, that's why being a cancer survivor sucks so much. As great as it is to be disease free, there's that whole other component of it that we don't often hear about.
Well, it's when you're getting your test results, whether it's, you know, cancer or HIV, I think a lot of physicians or clinicians or doctors, I don't know why they do this. It sometimes feels like you're on a reality TV show and they're like, James, are you ready for the test results? And you're like, just tell me what it is, you know? They build up to it.
My oncologist did not fuck around, and I appreciated that, because I wouldn't have been able to play games like that. I probably would have strangled him. No, I remember exactly how he used to deliver. He'd have a piece of paper. He would verbally tell me, James, there's no evidence of disease. He'd hand me the paper. And I treated those papers like diplomas. Like they were like trophies to me. I mean, I still have all of them. And I'm not really a sentimental person, but those definitely have sentimental value, because it shows I'm disease free. In my mind, if I could see it on paper, that meant it was true.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I certainly I had my own struggles with cancer, although not, I didn't have to do chemotherapy. You know, so it was a very aggressive skin cancer that I had on my shoulder, where they had to like do surgery and remove, you know, skin and muscle tissue. And, what I remember of the experience was not so much my reaction to it, but my friends and family were more, distressed about it than I was. Was that similar to you?
Yeah. You know, one of my colleagues, when I lost all my hair from the chemotherapy, she came up to me and she was like, she didn't know I had cancer. She was like, James, I can't get used to your summer haircut. And I was like, very bluntly, I said, I have cancer. And she broke down into tears right in front of me. Like, she knew she had just fucked up, but it was also the sense of, oh my God.
Yeah.
That is, like, I remember that in my brain. And that's one of those things where it's like, holy shit. There's other things, you know, people ask you a lot of dumb shit when you have cancer. Like, when it started to become public that I had cancer, one of my colleagues asked me, she's like, so is it terminal? And I'm like, what are you saying? Do you want me dead here? Like, I'm still trying to figure out if I'm going to make it through this. I don't want you thinking, oh, you know, like, why would you ask somebody that question? What interest do you have?
There is an innocence, though, I think, with people's questions, you know, and at least from my perspective, it's, you know, I've been through a lot already in life. And so having this, I was able to be more prepared for it. And, you know, certainly I had a father who also had the exact same cancer, you know, back in the day, it almost took his life, you know? So this is like something genetic. I come from Puerto Rico. I'm very fair skinned, you know, and now to this point that if I ever get a sunburned, like, you know, my friends go, watch out, you know, that, like every little thing that you do then gets scrutinized to some degree.
Right. That's true. And I will say, like, I think about cancer every day. I'm 10 years in remission and it's still something that crosses my mind. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about it. I generally eat very healthy, and some of my friends make fun of me, like, oh, is that because you had cancer? You know, they try to relate everything to the cancer experience too. For me, like you were saying, that there is innocence in what people say to you. I never shit on anybody who asks me about cancer, even no matter how stupid or ridiculous the question is, because
no, your dumb questions are stupid.
No, because I will say one of the most rewarding experiences is I've had a lot of people who just begun their cancer journey reach out to me, and I could just sense the fear in the questions they're asking, because I know what that is exactly like. And there are some things, like my doctor told me, you know, chemotherapy is going to be a little bit uncomfortable. No, that's an understatement. This shit is going to suck, and it's going to feel like you're dying, and you're going to want to be dead. Mm. I would have rather heard that than tell me it's going to be a little uncomfortable. And I think, I'm not saying everyone needs blunt language like that, but I think every cancer patient needs an honest assessment or reality check of what this is going to be like, because it's not going to be easy.
Do you feel like if you did get cancer again, would you go through chemotherapy again?
I've often thought about that, and I don't know the answer, but I don't feel like I would. That I don't know that I have another fight like that in me. Now, at the time I wasn't married, I'm married now. I might have that fight in me because I don't want to do that to my husband. Mm. But if I was a single guy, I think it would be an easy question to answer. No, I don't think I would. I think I would just accept my fate. This is time. It's my time. I can't believe we still treat cancer the way we do. Chemotherapy is a god-awful, torturous process. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize it's 8 hours. I would go in the morning and not leave till late afternoon while they pump me full of chemicals. You know, it's an awful process.
Mm.
What's your husband like?
He's different than me. He's got a sunny disposition. I do not. He's very approachable. he's one of those people who will say hi to you and talk to you if you're both sitting on the same bench. I'm not like that. He's also very tolerant because I'm very difficult, but he's also very headstrong. We're both veterans. He was in the Army. I was in the Marine Corps. He's a federal agent. So there's type A in him, but he's definitely not as rigid or... It's not as mean as
and,
I am.
And how'd you end up? You're in Hawaii now. Are you living there?
I am living here. We're here because of his job moved us here. That's why we're here.
Oh, what a lucky place to be.
What city are you in?
I'm in Honolulu.
Oh, wow. So if you get into arguments with your husband, he's like, hey, it's a federal crime to harass a federal agent.
Oh, yeah. He's threatened to arrest me many times. I mean, that's just
always keep
what
those
he does.
Handcuffs handy.
Well, you know, for different reasons. But yeah, he and it's funny because as much as journalism is my passion, being a criminal investigator is his passion. And I like to see that in people. I don't like to see people who just do jobs. Like when they get excited about something, like if he's working a case and there's some development in it, it's such a annoying yet beautiful experience.
Are you at this point retired as a journalist? Or I mean, you covered... You know, the killing of Osama bin Laden, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, many mass shootings, including the Boston Marathon bombing and the Trump campaign. A lot of heartbreaking, difficult things to witness, let alone write about and analyze.
True. I've also covered New Year's Eve in Key West, which I'm sure you know what that's about. Those are a lot of bad stories. I've done a lot of great stories, too. I don't work in journalism anymore. And in fact, all I do now is sell books. So, I don't think I'll ever get back into it. I think what happened to me is I got burnt out, as happens to a lot of people, especially in cable news, because cable news is not like other networks where you take a break. There's 24 hours that have to be filled with news. And for me, I did all I could do, I think. You know, my lifelong goal was to work at CNN, and I did it. That's the NFL of journalism. I reached that. What's next? I have no idea. And I don't like being asked that question because it makes me question all of my life.
How old are you today?
I'm 35.
I mean, let me put it this way. If I quit or retired, there would what would, there would be no podcasting today, you know?
It's That's true.
I mean, so so many amazing experiences in my life have happened after the age of 35, not before it. But for you, it sounds like maybe, you know, going to vacation in Hawaii with a nice federal agent and see. I mean, it seems like right now you're kind of like in a somewhat soft vacation, right?
I'm in a very good spot in life, and I can't complain. I won't complain about this, because personally I'm doing very well. Professionally, I'm sure I'll figure that out. And I got to do a lot of cool things in journalism that people spend literally 20, 30 years in their career trying to achieve. I know that. I'm so aware of that and so appreciative of the fact that I got to do that. But, you know, one of the ambassadors I worked for when I was a Marine Embassy Guard, she gave some very good advice. She's like, you don't have to have a single career. You can have more than one career in life. And I think a lot of us grow up thinking, oh my God, I'm only going to be this. I don't think that's true. I agree with that ambassador. You can do whatever the hell it is. You know, if you've had a 15-year journalism career and then you end it, that's still a successful career. If you move on to something different, that's okay too. I'm 35. I'm still old enough to do shit. I'm not decrepit in a home yet, you know?
Very wise words. Yes. And to add to that, it doesn't have to be 40 hours a week. You know, your second career can be 5 hours a week. It could be 80 hours a week. It could be anything you make it.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And I hate it when people say, oh, I encourage you to find work that you love and all that shit. Because I think that comes from a really privileged place. Because, you know, for some people, that's not just the reality. I acknowledge I'm very lucky in a lot of ways, even when I felt unlucky. So for me, yes, I will find whatever that is that excites me like journalism did. But for right now, I'm good.
James Curry, it's so great talking to you. Your book, Staying Alive, Surviving Abuse, Fighting a War, Beating Cancer, and Marrying a Hot Man Living in Hawaii is available.
Yes, thank you for
where fine books are found through our links at feastoffun.com. It's from Tonic Books, which is that's a publishing company that usually deals with cocktail recipes.
Yes, exactly.
It's so good talking to you. If you're ever in Chicago, come hang out with us. I'll make you a cocktail.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Do you drink? You don't drink, though, do you?
Yeah, occasionally, but not like the old days.
Yeah, neither do I. So I'd be like, where's the gin?
Right, exactly.
My old Marine roommate, I'd see him the next morning sometimes. He'd have bruises on his face. I'm like, what happened last night? He's like, I fell coming home. I'm like, why are you always falling coming home? He's like, I drink too much. I'm like, yeah.
I remember those days well. I remember those days well, and I don't ever want to go back to that.
Is it Annie Lennox said, don't mess with a military man?
That's missionary man.
Missionary man.
Gotcha.
Thank you, James, for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed your book, and I hope people check it out.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
You're welcome.
James Curry lives in Honolulu, Hawaii. You can get his book, Staying Alive, Surviving Abuse, Fighting a War, and Beating Cancer, My First 25 Years, through our website, feastoffun.com, and through the links in the show notes.
I really enjoyed reading the book, and I really enjoyed his story. And, I feel so bad for a lot of these veterans, because I really don't think that, you know, we as a nation really treat them well when they come home. And we sometimes just kind of like leave them to their own devices. And he does go in depth in the book talking about some of the post-traumatic stress that he endured and homelessness. I mean, we have so many homeless vets who have gone through crises, and, you know, they've served the country.
Right.
And they come back, and, you know, we just let them fend for themselves. And it's not the right way to treat people.
Well, and part of it is, you know, we don't have a good frame of reference in understanding the military in the United States and how much of our money goes into supporting this war machine that nobody, including Americans, need. And, you know, like when so many conversations have been happening about, if we, and this doesn't happen on CNN, for example, is if we just took 1%, 5%, a tiny fraction of the military budget and put that into stimulus checks, into fighting the COVID pandemic,
healthcare,
into keeping businesses open, like how many businesses have gone completely bankrupt? You know, Lord and Taylor department stores closed after hundreds of years being in business. Like so many institutions and businesses are not going to survive this pandemic. And that is a consequence of the fact that we don't value the people and the businesses and the culture of the United States. Mm. We value the war machine over everything else.
Well, and it's, you know, the rich people making the money from that war machine, they want those, that money coming in.
To the detriment of people's lives, yeah, and the quality of our lives. Yeah. And so, you know, like even, and that's the thing that sticks with me. It's like, you know, how can we support our military people when we don't support the civilians either? Mm. You know, we don't have healthcare for anybody. And with a pandemic, I mean, come on. It's like, if we're not going to realize the value of giving people universal healthcare, like how many, like 500,000 people died in the first year of the COVID pandemic. More than World War One and Two put together. And yet in the conversations that you see in politicians talking about it, they don't, it doesn't cross their minds or their mouths to talking about what we could have done to prevent that and how other countries and cultures were able to mitigate that harm because they don't invest so much money into their military. In fact, they have a centralized leadership that gave everybody universal healthcare. And so when they did deal with a pandemic, they knew who to turn to, where to go get tested, and what to do to lower those numbers.
Yeah, it's disheartening. And it's like we need to do better as a country.
In terms of the book, Stay Alive, you know, you read the, you're one,
I read
of,
the book.
You're probably the only person that James Curry will meet in the press of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Bless his heart, as they say in the South, that actually read the entire book from front to back. And, you know, there's a lot of juicy scenes in this book. What's something?
Well, I think
that,
the
like,
thing that touches the
you?
Most is, you know, yeah, a lot of people you realize in the military, is that's part of the thing they prey on. A lot of these kids come from, you know, poor, disenfranchised, abusive households. And so, you know, for them, the military is kind of a way to escape that. But then, you know, sometimes it's out of the frying pan and into the fire because, yeah, you know, you leave an abusive environment and then people are shooting at you. So, you know, is it a trade up? Is it a trade out? Now, for a lot of people, they say it can form them. It can form their identity, especially at a young age. It can give them that structure and they can carry that with them for the rest of their lives. But other people, the things that they see, the things that they experience, that side of the world, it can just have devastating effects. And so, you know, we do have a lot of people in the military that listen to this podcast and have for years or have been, you know, formerly in the military. And if they need help, if they reach out, there are resources out there. You have to find them, you talk to them, get help if you feel like you need help.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, something that really shaped my ability to my appetite for multidisciplinary development, mm-hmm, was watching Star Trek. You know, and this idea that it's a good thing to learn about, mm-hmm, how to build the ship and how to fix it, how to learn an appetite for anthropology and cuisine and music and culture and solutions and you know, in terms of you know, what the U.S. military does well is hopefully instill on people that kind of curiosity in learning about everything around them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Russian astronauts are called cosmonauts because they want to inspire upon them a hunger and passion for learning about everything, the cosmos. And I love that idea. I wish that, you know, more of our public schools and colleges had that approach and really, you know, had well-funded theater and music programs and not just, you know, STEM, science, technology, right, engineering, and
some
math.
Don't even have that.
And they don't even have that. They don't even, yeah, have a library, yeah, for, you know, we can't be like, consult your public library because there's no public library in your neighborhood, you know? And it's like, even with the internet, it's still like, there's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of manipulation. Mm-hmm. And so telling people to Google it or search it, that, you know, they might not reach the same conclusions you do.
Yeah.
And so hopefully, you know, like to me, in terms of journalism, 16 years, we're still here. We're only here because you guys made it possible. You, the listeners, decided Feast of Fun is something that's valuable to me.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have it. I wouldn't have this podcast. Mark and I would not have this platform to talk to you guys if you guys didn't financially support this show. And it is a profound...
it's an honor.
Honor.
You know, and it's a privilege, and I recognize that, and I'm happy to keep on doing it. You know, as long as you guys want the show is here for you. And the best way to support the show is to become a Plus member, and you can do that at feastoffun.com/plus or make a one-time donation. You can do that at feastoffun.com/donate. Every little bit helps. Every little bit keeps us going forward and moving forward. And we want to continue to be here to present people like James so you can learn from their experience.
Yeah, right now, like in Chicago, there are a few, I don't know, very, like I can count in my hand the number of LGBT news organizations or journalists working. And we're like, what? I'm like, and we're, you know, mostly comedians, we're entertainers, we're not, we're sort of being roped and pulled into doing journalism because there is a vacuum of people asking questions and interviewing people and bringing up these difficult topics and ideas in a way that is accessible to people, right? So, you know, people are like, you don't need to sugarcoat it, you don't need to feed it to me in a spoon. And it's like, it's not about that. It's about making sure that people have access to this information so that other generations can learn about what it was like to be in the closet or to be gay and serve in the war in Iraq. You know, like you may not have known about James Curry's book if you didn't listen to the podcast today. And this might be the book that you needed to hear. And, you know, you may have just discovered that you're facing some terrible medical trauma. And, you know, James Curry book might be the book, the guide of overcoming that and finding resilience in those challenges that you have. But it wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for the other people that listen to this podcast and make Feast of Fun possible. So from the bottom of my heart to you guys,
I want
to say
too.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mark, for being
Thank you, Fausto, for producing the show.
You're very welcome.
Co-host Ant.
I'll take my thank yous, the box of chocolates.
Ooh, that does sound good.
Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.